is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio and every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as television by the Dish on both Dish Network and DirecTV and cable systems nationwide by Free Speech TV. It is Friday, the first hour of our program. Senator Bernie Sanders, our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Sanders, welcome.
Good to be with you, Tom.
Great to have you with us, sir. And curious your thoughts on the events of the last few weeks and where we go from here. And it's been an eventful month.
It has. There's a whole lot that's been happening. Let me review a very significant piece of legislation that passed the Congress against my vote, passed the Congress, the House and the Senate against my vote last week, and that is the $1 trillion appropriations bill. The argument for voting for that bill is a reasonable argument, is that nobody wants to see the government shut down and the Republicans place the Democratic leadership in that take-it-or-leave-it position. On the other hand, there were too many bad things in that bill, really embarrassingly bad things for me to support it. And there were three major concerns that I had among many. Number one, what has not been widely discussed is that 60% or a little bit less than 60% of that $1 trillion goes to the Defense Department. And I think as a nation, we have got to take a hard look at our national priorities. We have got to determine whether or not at a time our infrastructure is collapsing. Families can't afford to send their kids to college. We have the highest rate of childhood poverty in the industrialized world. Our middle class is disappearing. Whether in the middle of all of that, we should be spending close to $600 billion a year on the military, which is almost as much as the rest of the world combined. So that's issue number one. Issue number two is in that bill, there was a provision which repealed a portion of Dodd-Frank financial regulation legislation, which basically said that the taxpayers of this country were never again going to bail out the financial institutions which engaged in risky derivative speculation. And that was repealed. And that particular provision was literally written by the folks at Citigroup. They wrote it, they got it into the bill, and now what happens is these guys are going to once again be investing in incredibly complicated, risky endeavors, and if they win, they make a lot of money, and if they lose, guess what? Taxpayers of America bail them out. I think that's totally absurd. And the third provision, which concerned me, also did not get a whole lot of discussion, is that language in that bill lays the groundwork for many, many hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of American workers to see a significant reduction in the pensions that they were promised and in some cases are now receiving. So you have situations where somebody may have worked for a company for 20, 30, 40 years with a full understanding that he or she was going to be getting a pension, is getting that pension right now. And as a result of problems with the multi-employer pension funds around this country, suddenly they're going to see that pension significantly reduced. This kind of came upon Congress very quickly without sufficient discussion. We have to figure out how we deal with the pension problem in this country, but the answer is not simply to cut the pensions that were promised to workers. That is absolutely wrong. And what really bothers me is it sets a horrendous precedent, is that no matter what anyone says to you about what you're entitled to, that could be taken away at a moment's notice. So for those reasons, I voted against that piece of legislation. As I think most listeners and viewers know, the other day, President Obama, I think, did something that was absolutely right, long overdue, in terms of moving toward establishing normal diplomatic relations with Cuba. I was in Cuba 6-7 months ago, had the opportunity to meet with Alan Gross. Very glad to see that he has been released. Glad to see that the United States will be opening up an embassy in Havana and vice versa. You know, I think we're in a situation where I'm talking to you right now is 1 hour away from the Canadian border. And in Canada, people want to go to Cuba to vacation, to shop. Businesses want to do business in Cuba. They're able to do it. Here in the United States, we are limited. We cannot, in many, most cases, travel to Cuba, and I think that that's wrong. So I think the effort is, the president's effort is a good effort, and I support it, and I hope that we make good progress in that area. Last point that I want to make is that now that the campaign is over, we are beginning to, of course, learn what the Republicans really want to do, which is certainly not what they talked about during the campaign. During the campaign, all they talked about was Obama, 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 and that he was responsible for every problem in the history of the world, not telling us what they want to do. And now, of course, we know what they want to do, which is certainly not a surprise to many of us. It's the part of the Republican DNA, and that is to go after Social Security and go after Medicare and make devastating cuts to the programs that working families desperately need. I am the new chairman of the House Budget Committee, replacing Paul Ryan. It's a fellow named Congressman Price from North Carolina. He'll be chairman of the Budget Committee, and he made it very clear that one of his top priorities will be so-called entitlement reform, which in one form or another will mean major cuts to Social Security and Medicare. And they'll probably go back to what Paul Ryan did in his budget, which is to end Medicare as we know it, transforming it into a voucher system by which seniors will be given a check in which they can then go out to the private sector and try to buy insurance from a private insurance company. And you just think about what it would mean to somebody who's, you know, 75 years of age, who has a check and who is dealing with cancer or some other serious illness, and what kind of policy they're going to be getting from a private insurance company, and it will not be a very good policy, to say the least. In terms of Social Security, I'm not quite sure which approach they'll use. They may want to raise the retirement age. They may want to go to the chain CPI, which cuts back on cost of living adjustments. But whatever it is, at a time when millions of seniors are struggling on, you know, $10,000, $12,000, $14,000 a year, when Social Security is a very, very important part of their total income, for many people, it is all of their income, or 90% of their income. It is absolutely unthinkable that anyone would want to cut Social Security benefits or benefits for disabled veterans. And what we have got to do in this, Tom, and is the ranking member, I will, it was recently announced that I will be the ranking member, the leader of the minority on the budget committee, so it's going to give me a pretty good place to make this fight. But I am determined to do everything that I can, not only to prevent cuts to Social Security and Medicare, but to strengthen those programs. And in terms of Social Security, I think we all know what has got to happen. And as you lift the cap right now, if you're making $1 million a year or $10 million a year, you're putting into the Social Security Trust Fund the same amount of money as somebody making $117,000. So if you lift that cap, and even if you start at $250,000 a year, what you can do is extend the life of Social Security for many decades. Right now, Social Security can pay out every benefit for the next 19 years, but we want to extend it well beyond that, and you can expand benefits as well. And when so many seniors are struggling as to whether or not they are able to buy the medicine they need or heat their homes or buy the food they need, that is exactly what we have to do. But to be successful on that, it's not going to be done with inside the Beltway negotiations. The only way we beat these guys is when we rally millions of Americans who say, guess what, you are not going to cut Social Security and you're not going to cut Medicare. So we're going to be working hard in that area as well.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our national town hall meeting, Brunch with Bernie. Senator Sanders will be taking your calls for the rest of the hour, so get ready. And by the way, you can check out Bernie's website at sanders.senate.gov.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And you can also sign up for Bernie's newsletter, the Bernie Buzz, over at sanders.senate.gov. Check it out. And welcome back, Senator. All set for calls?
Let's do it.
Okay, Jim in Lockport, Illinois, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You are on the air, Senator Sanders.
Senator Sanders, how are you?
Great. How are you, Jim?
I'd like to go back to that Cromney bus bill that that they passed. What is it going to take for the American people to wake up and really see how the Republican Party is just tearing the middle class apart? It just baffles me the way they go about it, and people just keep going along with it. You know, we got to get people out there to vote. It's just unbelievable.
Well, Jim, thanks for your call, and you asked a very important question. I think, obviously, I was very disappointed in the results of the election, where the Republicans won a significant victory and are now going to take over the Senate. But what disappointed me, and should disappoint everybody and upset everybody, is not just, you know, Republican victory, but that 63% of the American people did not vote in that election. Some 80% of young people, the future of the country, did not vote in that election. And 75-80% of low-income workers did not vote in this election. So the question really is, you know, what kind of democracy are we when vast majority of people don't vote, and especially the future of the country don't vote? And I think that speaks to a significant demoralization on the part of the American people in terms of believing that democracy works for them, that government works for them rather than for the big money and the special interests. And that is the essence of the issue. It's a catch-22. If we can show the government can do good things for working families, people will vote. But if the government does not do that, people will not vote. So we need to work extremely hard to create a grassroots movement which demands that Congress does the right things for working people. And that is an endeavor that I've been involved in for years, and we will continue to push. So that's kind of where we are. People have got to stand up and fight back and make it clear to Washington that government must work for the middle class and working families of this country, and not just for the billionaires and multinational corporations.
Ron in Fairhaven, Vermont. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
We're receiving an enormous amount of advertising in our mailbox. Do you know, Bernie, if the very low rates for mailing advertising being subsidized by our first-class rates? Thank you.
Thanks, Ron. The issue of the Postal Service is something we have been very, very heavily involved in. My impression is that the Postal Service makes money doing that.
Third-class mail does make them a profit.
And, you know, I want to see them make a profit. And, you know, what may be junk mail to one person may be the opportunity to get a coupon and save some money for another person. So, but we have worked very, very hard on postal issues. I worry very much about slowdown in mail delivery service and the shutting down of some 82 processing plants and the shrinking of the labor force of the Postal Service by 15,000 workers. So we're working as hard as we can to try to make sure that the Postal Service gets the revenue they need in order to do high-quality work.
We'll be right back with more Senator Bernie Sanders right after this. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie Hour, our national town hall meeting with Senator Bernie Sanders, taking your calls. Rick in Tampa, Florida. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi. This is Rick from Tampa, Florida. My question for Senator Sanders is, when can we expect you to formally announce that you are going to run for president in 2016?
Hey, Rick, thanks very much for the question and for your support. This is a huge decision. And if I do it, it has to be done well. It has to be a campaign designed to win. And when you were a candidate taking on every special interest in this country and the Koch brothers and the oil companies and the military industrial complex and Wall Street and the drug companies, you know, you're taking on the real power in America. And I will not do it unless I have the sense that there is the grassroots support, not only people who are prepared to vote for me, but people prepared to engage in an almost unprecedented grassroots movement. I just came back from Iowa, and I spoke at a couple of groups in Iowa. And I got to tell you, there was a lot of support there, and I felt very good about the meetings that we had. Large turnouts, a lot of enthusiasm. But, you know, we have time to make that decision, and I've got to make the right decision. And it's not just for me. It's not just my ego that says I want to do it well. If I run, I'll be carrying the banner of millions of people who want government to work for the middle class, who believe that health care is a right of all people, who want to see millions of new jobs being created, rebuilding our infrastructure, believe in pay equity, who want to address climate change, all of those issues. And if it's not done well, all of those causes suffer a setback. If it's done well, then we gain on that. I happen to believe there is real anger in this country at what's happening to working families and the fact that 95% of all new income goes to the top 1%. Is there the will, Rick? Is there the will of people to stand up and take on the billionaire class? Is there that will? And the answer is, at this moment, I don't know. And I'm working as hard as I can to try to ascertain whether there is that kind of desire and willingness on the part of the American people to stand up. So if I do it, it has to be done well. I don't want to do it poorly, and that's what we're looking at right now.
Jeff in Elkton, Maryland. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Hope you have a nice holiday. I have a question that is related to the filibuster. Everybody knew that the writers were in this bill, and I was trying to figure out why, if the Senate knew about these writers in there, why? Where was the consensus on a filibuster? I mean, where was it at? I mean, apparently people or the Democrats on my party didn't want to filibuster that. And I'm trying to figure out how many people does it really take to filibuster? Is it just one or a group that can do that? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you very much.
To answer your question, it can be one. It can be a group. I was on the floor a few years ago protesting against an agreement that President Obama reached with the Republicans, maintaining a lot of Bush's tax breaks for the rich, and I was on the floor for 8.5 hours. One can go on the floor for, you know, 10 hours, 20 hours, whatever, and other people can come on as well. But be clear, and I think sometimes people are not clear about this. If you filibuster, what you do is primarily call attention to the issue, and that may very well be a good thing to do. I was on the floor. I did not filibuster. I was on the floor on several occasions calling attention to this. Others were as well, especially this outrageous provision which rescinds taxpayer protection against Wall Street speculation. But what it would have done is delayed the vote for 10 or 12 hours or 14 hours. It would not have, it would have maybe focused more attention on it. But I think by and large, most Americans know what was in that bill by now, and that it was, in my view, a bill that should not have been passed.
Rudy in Riverside, Illinois. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yeah, hi. Senator Sanders, are there any progressive Republicans in the House or the Senate that would organize with the progressive Democrats to pass progressive legislation as a coalition or form a third party? And are you and other Democrats going to tell the people about the poison pill that the Republicans put into this spending legislation?
Well, Rudy, to answer your first part of your question, are there any Republicans prepared to work with progressive Democrats in the House or the Senate? I'm not all that familiar with the House, but in the Senate, I really cannot think of any. I may be wrong, but I cannot think of any senators who come close to want to work with progressives on any significant issue. I think that, and in terms of the poison bill and the appropriations bill, I think we discussed that already, and some of us have discussed that a whole lot. In terms of where we are right now, I think that the goal has got to be to make sure that the President of the United States tells the Republicans very loudly and clearly that if they want to cut Social Security, they want to cut Medicare, Medicaid, education, environmental protection, whatever, that the President will veto that legislation. And if he vetoes that legislation, I am very confident that both in the House and the Senate, or either in the House or the Senate, we will be able to sustain that veto, and that legislation will not get through. So I think it is clear Republicans won a victory in November. We got to figure out ways to work together. I think one way we can work together, some Republicans have talked for years about the need to pay attention to our crumbling infrastructure. And that's hopefully a bipartisan issue that we can work together on. There are some Republicans, Mitt Romney among others, who have talked about the need to raise the minimum wage. I hope there are some Republicans in Congress who are sympathetic. There are some Republicans who talk about equal rights for women in terms of fair pay. And I hope we can work with pay equity. But there are areas that we can work together. But mostly, I think the president has got to make it clear that he will not support legislation which attacks the needs of working families.
It's Brunch with Bernie here on the Tom Hartman Program, our hour-long town hall meeting, national town hall meeting with Senator Sanders. We'll be back with more of your questions for Bernie right after this.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And check out Bernie's site, sanders.senate.gov. You can also go over to Facebook and plug his name in. You'll find a very active Facebook page. Welcome back to the place where we dare to ask, is Walmart a person or Hobby Lobby or anybody else? No, we say. Here on the Tom Hartman Program, it's our Brunch with Bernie hour. Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls, and you're with us, Senator, right?
I am right here.
Okay, great. Tom in Temecula, California, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. It's an honor to speak to the both of you, and I think that I speak for many of your listeners when I say you're both the national treasures. I have an idea that's so crazy it might be genius, but I would like, because of the Electoral College, Bernie would need to belong to a party to become president, so I suggest that he runs as a Republican. Talking heads at Fox would explode. All the independents would cross over, like myself, and vote for you. Re-register all of the Democrats as Republicans during the primaries to make sure you get there. They certainly need your history on perspective, and you could cork the Tea Party with the unequal taxes and the big government equals corporate welfare and bank bailouts and those kind of things that they appeal to. And once you're elected, you should make Tom your domestic policy advisor.
Thank you, Tom.
Okay, Tom, that's a pretty crazy idea. You're right. Well, here's what I think. What is not crazy, Tom, is that, and I think you are making this point, despite media analysis to the contrary, on some of the major issues facing this country, there is a lot more commonality of thought than many believe. You know, I'm not going to tell you that on issues like gun control or gay marriage or abortion, et cetera, that on those issues the country is not divided. It is divided, and that's the way it is. But on the basic economic issues, your point about many of these Tea Party folks, especially the working class Tea Party members, they're as angry as everybody else's, and they're angry for the right reason. I'll tell you a funny story. Some years ago, I was on Fox TV, and somehow or another, I was able to really talk about some of the issues that I wanted to talk about. One of the issues I talked about was trade and the horrendous impact that NAFTA and CAFTA and permanent normal trade relations with China and other unfettered free trade agreements have had on American workers. You know, we've lost some 60,000 factories in this country since 2001, millions of decent paying jobs, and not all of it, but a lot of it is attributable to our disastrous trade policies. And when I got back to my office, you know, the machines were lighting up with all of these Fox calls who said, you know, I don't agree with you on a lot of issues, but you're right on this trade issue. And there are other issues out there. I think many of our conservative friends were not sympathetic to the bailout of Wall Street, et cetera. So the challenge that we face on economic issues is how we bring people together where there is common belief and common interest. A poll came out a while ago asking Tea Party people whether they thought there should be cuts in Social Security. Overwhelmingly, they said no. So what our job is to reach out not to the corporate wing of the Republican Party. You know, they have their agenda, which is to give more tax breaks to the rich and cut programs for working families and support unfettered free trade, but to working class conservatives, who I think we can make common alliance with, not on all issues, but on many issues.
Dan, in Atlanta, Georgia, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Happy, healthy holiday to you and your family, Senator and Tom.
Thank you.
Bernie, I wanted to get your thoughts about the recent announcement by Governor Shumlin that they're canceling the single-payer plan in Vermont, which I feel is a travesty, not just for your state, but for the country, because this, you know, was the foundation for what should be going on here in the United States. I mean, the talk that they're saying, well, the taxes would increase so much. And to that, my response is well, of course,
right,
paid for.
Thank you for the question, Dan. Obviously, I talked to the governor the other day. He gave me a ring to tell me what he was going to say. And you're right. It is very, very disappointing, because it has been my hope, and it is my hope, that Vermont will lead the country into a single-payer healthcare system and, by example, have a profound impact on the nation. I think what the governor concluded at this particular point is that the kind of tax increases that would be required would be too high politically or economically, financially, to be sustainable at this moment. But let me just tell you, Dan, that that fight is not going to be given up, not if I have anything to say for it. The current healthcare system is dysfunctional in so many respects. We have 40 million people who have no health insurance today, despite the modest gains of the Affordable Care Act. Millions more of high premiums and high deductibles. We remain the only country in the industrialized world, as you know, that does not guarantee healthcare to all people. And yet we end up spending almost twice as much per capita on healthcare as any other nation. And our healthcare outcomes are not particularly good. So we're going to go back to the drawing board. I will be meeting with the governor and with the healthcare advocates here in the state of Vermont to figure out where we go from here. But what I want to tell you, Dan, is that fight is far from over. We're going to continue the fight. Single payer is the direction that we have got to go as a state and, in my view, as a nation.
John, in Elmwood Park, Illinois, you're on the air with Senator Sanders, John.
Senator Sanders, I thank you for all you do for veterans in the middle class. I really hope you run for president. Things are pretty crazy right now politically. You know, Obama's going for the TPP, and who would have ever thought that? But I think you can win as president. You might have to go against Hillary, but maybe you'll raise enough issues where she can pick his VP, worst case scenario. But that'll be your legacy if you run for president, so I hope you do it. My question to you is, what's being done to audit the Federal Reserve? And my question is, Tom talks about failed Reaganomics, and he's 100% right that Reaganomics has failed, and it should have died in 2008. But the Federal Reserve has been printing money and doing 0% interest and all these federal gimmicks to prop up, the wealthy. So my question is, what's being done to audit the Fed? I know there's something going on with Rand Paul on the other side about auditing the Fed. So I'm wondering if you have any plans to get audit the Fed legislation through.
Well, what you should know, John, is, and I'm pretty proud of this, is part of the Dodd-Frank financial regulation bill. I got an amendment in which, for the first time in the history of the United States of America, did audit the Fed, but only, and the compromise we had to make to get it in, was only during the financial crisis. And what we learned was incredibly revelatory. We learned that the Fed, and we would not have known this without the provision that I got in, lent out in a revolving loan fund, so money coming in, money going out, some $16 trillion to virtually every major financial institution in the United States and central banks all over the world, and a number of major American corporations at almost zero interest loans, very zero interest or very, very low interest loans. And the lesson that we learn from that knowledge is that when the Fed felt it appropriate, they could do some rather remarkable things. They wanted to save the Wall Street folks, they lent out unbelievable sums of money. And yet when it comes to small businesses or families that have kids in college, apparently we can't do the same thing for them. So the issue of auditing the Fed is alive and well. I work with Congressman Ron Paul, when he was in the House. We didn't get everything we wanted, but we got something. And I will continue to work on significant Fed reform. A lot of issues in the Fed, not least of which is that we still have the banking community dominating the Fed. And we want to, there's such an obvious conflict of interest. We want to get rid of the bankers on the regional Feds. But there's a lot of work to be done that, and we're going to stay on that issue.
Faith in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi. I just want to understand more clearly. Thank you for taking my call, first of all, and it's an honor to talk to both of you guys. The pensions that you're talking about in the spending bill, whose pensions exactly are they? I mean, my husband and I are on a fixed income, and we both receive a pension for a number of years now. Is it people who haven't taken their pensions yet that are still paying in? I just want to understand it.
Okay, Faith, I will give you... Sorry, I don't have the paper in front of me, so I don't want to misspeak here. But what we are talking about are multi-employer pension funds that have been established by companies working together along with unions to establish pension funds. I believe there are about 1,400 of them. Some of them within the next several decades are not going to be able to pay out what was promised to their workers. So you have about 1,400 plans, and some of them, several hundred, I believe, within the next several years, the next several decades, will not be able to pay out all of the benefits owed to the people in the plan. What this legislation did, and I think that was absolutely wrong, is create a situation where some of these multi-employer funds could, in some cases, significantly reduce the pensions that people are already receiving, as well as future pensions. So to answer your question, yes, it does apply, in some cases, to people who are already receiving pensions. I think what was excluded from that are people, if my memory is correct, over 75 years of age. So the oldest people would not be impacted. But people under 75 could receive cuts, and in some cases, pretty significant cuts.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, our national town hall meeting. Check out his website at sanders.senate.gov. We'll be right back with your calls for Bernie.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And at Sanders.Senate.gov, you can sign up for the Bernie Buzz, Bernie's newsletter. And over on Facebook, you can find a very active Bernie Sanders. And welcome back. Dan, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV in Tell City, Indiana. You are on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hello, I was wondering why you can't, Republicans always put these riders in these bills. Why can't you put, get creative and put a rider in there for Glass-Steagall and reinstate it? Let's call it Warren Sanders, and not just in one bill, but just continually put it in somewhere every month.
Well, Dan, I think that's exactly right. And that is, you know, something that I have very much in the back of my mind to attempt to do. We have got to address this power of Wall Street and the greed of Wall Street and the ability of Wall Street to make risky investments that the taxpayers of this country are going to have to, you know, bail them out when they're wrong. So, you know, those are issues, and putting in riders is something that is exactly what I have in mind.
Mike in Haines City, Florida, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders. Mike is watching his TV instead of listening to his telephone. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Yes, Senator. Thanks for another year of great work. Partly blaming the Democrats for this piece of crap budget is like blaming a husband who pays ransom to get his wife back for the kidnapping. If the Democrats had voted against this budget, it would have played right into the Republicans' hands. The government would shut down, and hundreds of thousands of jobs would be destroyed, exactly what the Republicans want. And since the Republicans now control the entire Congress and the media, the Democrats would get all the blame. Isn't that true? Senator, and can you imagine the budget we would have gotten in January?
Well, Paul, you raise fair questions, and you know, this becomes a contentious and difficult debate. I think with the Republicans controlling the House and being extremely aggressive, we know that in the past they have been prepared and did shut down the government. We know that come March or April or May or June, they may be prepared to have the United States for the first time in the history of our country not pay the money that we owe and maybe plunge the entire world into a great financial crisis. They are very, very aggressive folks. But there comes a point, and, you know, and you got to look at every case as it comes down the road. But there comes a point where I think Democrats have got to say, no, we just can't go down that path. And if you guys want to take responsibility for shutting down the government, if you want to plunge this world into a financial crisis, well, you have to take that responsibility. But we are not going to continue to vote for things which are devastating to working families or just another boondoggle for Wall Street. So, you know, Paul, I think your point is a fair point, and it's worthy of a lot of discussion. But my own view is that the other side of the story from what you're laying out is that people say, okay, the Democrats voted for this giveaway to Wall Street. Democrats voted to cut pensions. What the hell is the difference between the two parties? Why am I going to vote? So all of this stuff is tough, tough stuff. There is no easy answer to it. But I think we've got to be a little bit more thoughtful and think this thing through in a way that we haven't in the past.
Senator Bernie Sanders with us. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. Back more of Senator Sanders right after this. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. It's our Brunch with Bernie hour with Senator Bernie Sanders taking your calls. And Paul in Woodinville, Washington, you're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Hi, Tom. Best of the season to both of you.
You too.
Thank you.
Senator, I wanted to ask you, do you think when, if ever, will the United States Congress return to normal budgetary procedures? I mean, the Republicans seem to be crowing the fact that this bill leaves spending cuts at sequester levels, but it seems to me that that is sort of like saying, I want to lose weight, but I don't care if I lose fat or muscle or bone or organ tissue or brain tissue. I just want to lose weight. That's not a healthy way to live, and I don't think that's a healthy way to govern. We still have billions in bloated military spending, which has absolutely no value-added benefit to the American people. Yet they want to make cuts to things that do have value-added benefit to the American people. Yet, and all of these other things, deregulations crammed in, all crammed into one bill with no debate. Is this what would be called cakeistocratic, and then that's Kissingerese for the worst way to govern.
Well, Paul, I couldn't agree with you more. It is a horrendous way to govern. Major provisions in legislation which have not been seriously debated or where there are hearings on. But, Paul, I want you to take a look at what's going on in Congress, maybe from another perspective, and to understand that, sadly, and I say this with a great deal of sadness, but it is the truth, it is an illusion to believe that the Congress today, especially the Republicans, come anywhere close in their policies to representing where the American people are at. They get funded very, very heavily by the Koch brothers and by large corporations and wealthy individuals. And their agenda is primarily the agenda of those people. What we have got to understand is the Republican agenda is an agenda of tax breaks for the wealthy and large corporations, and what you saw, and a tax on working families. And what you saw in the last appropriations bill that we just voted on last week, what I voted against, is just that, encapsulated in one bill, a major break for Wall Street, forcing taxpayers to pick them up when they lose money, and an attack on working families in the ability now of pensions for a whole lot of workers to be cut significantly. So you're not talking about a rational process. You're not talking about a process which in which government is representing ordinary people. You're talking about a process in which the United States Congress represents the wealthy and the powerful. And that's the agenda that you're seeing. And it's a sad state of affairs. And it's not going to change. It will not change until there's a political revolution in this country. We will have folks going to Washington saying, you know what? What my constituents tell me is we need a jobs program to put people back to work, not more boondoggles for Wall Street. We need tax breaks. We don't need tax breaks for the rich and large corporations. What we need is raising the minimum wage. So, you know, you're going to need a Congress that starts reflecting the needs of the American people, not just big money interests.
Okay. Michael in Stillwater, New Jersey. You're on the air with Senator Sanders.
Bernie, thank you and Tom for taking the call. My question is more procedural in the sense that all these riders and amendments that are stuck onto the CRS and the omnibus bills and the like don't really have – we don't know who sponsored them, so to speak. How is it that we can get the Senate or the Congress – and I know you can speak from the Senate – on a procedural level to make sure that these bonds, these bills or these amendments or riders have a name attached to them and who's going to sign on to it, so there's some sort of accountability relative to who are actually sponsoring these things.
Your point is well taken, and that is something that I and I think many of us will be working on. The danger, and it's, believe me, not a new idea, it's gone on for many, many years, is that very significant pieces of legislation get stuck in big bills and nobody knows anything about them. And we've got to do our best to prevent that from happening. By the way, Tom, I think I misspoke a few moments ago. The chairman of the new chairman of the budget committee is a Republican, is Tom Price. I think I said David Price, who was also a congressman from North Carolina. David is a Democrat. He is not going to be the chairman of the committee by any means. But it is Tom Price who will be the chairman. I misspoke on that.
That's quite all right. We have just a minute and a half left, Senator.
All right, let me wrap it up. We got a lot of very good questions. I think people are concerned about the process that goes on in Washington. People are concerned that what goes on in Congress is reflective of the needs of major campaign contributors and big money interests. And the only way I know, to be very frank with you, to fight back is when people are organized, when they are vocal, when they're prepared to speak out, when they are prepared to get on the telephone and make it clear to their members of Congress, Senate, and the House that they know what's going on, that they are not going to tolerate more legislation designed to protect the 1% or more legislation designed to hurt working families. And let me be very clear. This is what is, you know, Tom, you and I talked about this months ago, and now it's shaping up. This is exactly what the Republican agenda is, and everybody should be aware of it. They want to go after Social Security. One way or the other, they want to cut Social Security. We can beat them if we organize and make it clear that we know what's going on. They want to end Medicare as we know it. They want to give more tax breaks to the wealthy and large corporations. They want to cut back on education, nutrition, environmental protection, affordable housing. That is their agenda. And we can beat them. But the only way we beat them is when the American people speak up and say, sorry, that is not what we want. You got to represent us and not just the billionaire class.
Senator, thanks so much for being with us again this week today.
All right. My pleasure.
Great talking to you. We'll be back right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters: Identity Guard, Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. It's Friday. We're going to do Anything Goes Friday here today. A couple of things that I wanted to mention. It's the U.S. government is now acknowledging or asserting, I'm not sure which, that North Korea was largely behind, perhaps with the help of China or perhaps simply routing things through China or with North Korean agents in China. Behind the hack of Sony Pictures. Now, there's a lot of writing going on over in the business press about how Sony Pictures, you know, has just been lousy on security for years and years. And they've been hacked many times in the past and haven't really done the appropriate things that they should do and quack, quack, quack. So there was that conversation. There was another conversation about what was the content of the emails that were being released? You know, did this did the head of Sony Pictures actually make jokes about President Obama's race, et cetera? And a lot of us, when those stories were playing in the media, were scratching our heads going, why is this the story rather than the fact that a foreign government has apparently hacked a major corporation, now it's a Japanese-owned corporation, but it's a major corporation doing business here in the United States, has been hacked, and I believe it's Japanese-owned. I don't know to what extent Sony is publicly traded these days or in which markets or where, but you know, it certainly started out as a Japanese company. But the point is, you know, why is nobody talking about this is basically an act of war against a company, but it's happening inside our country? And George Clooney just came out. This is over in The Guardian. And he said that he had put together a petition, a letter, saying basically, you know, we're pretty horrified. Well, in fact, he said a good portion of the press abdicated its real duty with just a little bit of work. You could have found out that it wasn't just probably North Korea. It was North Korea. It was a serious moment in time. It needs to be addressed seriously as opposed to frivolously. And then he went to a bunch of, you know, famous actors and people and said, do you want to sign this petition? And he says, all that it is basically saying is we're not going to give into a ransom. As we watched one group be completely vilified, nobody stood up. Nobody took that stand, Clooney said. Nobody wanted to be the first to sign on. Now, this isn't finger pointing on that. This is just where we are right now, how scared this industry has been made. He said, this is a situation we're going to have to come to terms with a new paradigm and a new way of handling our business, because this could happen to an electric company, a car company, a newsroom. It could happen to anybody. Understand what is going on right now, because the world just changed on your watch and you weren't even paying attention. I mean, it's an issue that is not, in my opinion, is not being discussed in the proper frame, which is the frame that Clooney's talking about. And I think we all have to realize that internet security increasingly is an oxymoron. You know, nobody's, quote, really safe. So My phone recently croaked, and I had to go back to an old phone that only answers the phone and takes text messages. And it's kind of liberating, you know, to not be able to check my email while I'm walking around the streets and things. But that said, anyhow, there's a lot going on here. We talked a lot about medical marijuana yesterday. I know that some people still want to talk about that. There's this, you know, the many things that Bernie just brought up. President Obama's flying out to Hawaii today. So, you know, the news cycle is slowing down. So let's just pick up some phone calls and get going with Anything Goes Friday. John, listening to SiriusXM in Indianapolis, Indiana. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Thank you, Tom, so much for taking my call. And I want to switch gear here a little bit from the Sony issue and talk about the fact that the Supreme Court has agreed to accept a challenge to the Affordable Care Act regarding the subsidy that is helping millions of people be able to afford health care.
Right.
And the issue over the language, as I understand it, is that if you sign up through a state exchange, you qualify for the subsidy. But if you sign up through the federal exchange, you do not qualify. And so the intent, really, as I understand it, when the act was first passed, it was for everybody to be able to afford health care.
Right.
But nobody is really talking about the fact that the Supreme Court may rule against this subsidy for those who signed up through the federal exchange. And so, I mean, that's a major, major issue. I wish I could have gotten to Senator Sanders on that. But there needs to be some kind of effort to get the Congress to make that language change to include those who sign up through the federal exchange.
Yeah, this problem could be solved with probably six or seven sentences on a single piece of paper as a very simple amendment to the ACA by Congress. It could be easily solved, and it would not need to be an issue sitting before the United States Supreme Court. The reality, however, John, is that the Congress, the House of Representatives, and the Senate are now both in Republican hands. And this Republican Party is absolutely opposed to the idea that everybody in America should have health insurance and or health coverage, and in particular, low-income people should get a subsidy to provide that money is going to come from rich people to help poor people have health insurance. That idea to the Republican Party smacks of communism. They are horrified by it, and there's no way that they are going to fix the ACA. They want it to go down in flames, and they want to take us back to the days when billionaires running multi-billion-dollar health insurance companies make their money by telling you and me, when we get sick, you know, screw off. We're going to do what's called a rescission and cancel your policy, or we're going to refuse to cover this sickness that you've got because, you know, you forgot to tell us that back when you were 16 years old, you took this acne medication. That was an actual real case. And, you know, these kind of things. So, you know, I absolutely appreciate and share your sentiment, John, but it ain't going to happen for the next 2 years. So it's going to, you know, we'll see what the Supreme Court does. And the law of unintended consequences, you never know. I mean, the Supreme Court might blow up the ACA, and then the Republicans, we'll see. The Republicans could take some serious, hits on that. A lot's going to depend on how the president and the Republicans spin the news cycle. And they don't have a good record on that, which makes me very concerned. John, thanks for the call. John, driving through Atlanta. Hey, John.
Hi, Mr. Hartman. I really missed out on Senator Sanders, but thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I was going to ask if knew, or perhaps one of your listeners knew, whether or not the president was able to make an adjustment to the FDIC in light of the rather risky behavior of the banks. To change the its insurance.
Right.
I mean, insurance is always...
FDIC insurance, I'm pretty sure, is a matter of statute. I mean, there's probably some tinkering around the edges that can be done as a matter of policy within the executive branch. But the idea that the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation is insuring the deposits of people in banks that pay the FDIC insurance to be insured... I don't think that by executive order the president can fix what this legislation did. I could be wrong though, and John, like you said, let's toss this out. Maybe some of our listeners know. Thank you for the call. It would be great if he could. I mean, if President Obama could simply say, you know, okay, fine, you know, the big banks are now, or their depositors, they can gamble with the depositors' money and they don't have to worry about it going away because, hey, if they steal the depositors' money, the FDIC will replace it. And possibly he could fix that with an executive order, but I just seriously doubt it.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back with Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. Be right. Welcome back. Anita in San Antonio, Texas. You're on the air, Anita. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Hi, Tom. First of all, I want to thank you and Danielle and Shano and everyone there for everything you do. You respect your listeners' intelligence. You don't pander to the lowest common denominator.
Thank you.
So I want to thank you for that. I can't give as much as I like to Free Speech TV, but what I've done is I've asked my family, instead of giving me a gift, to donate to Free Speech TV.
Well, that's great.
But what I called about actually was I have a couple major concerns that I wanted to talk to Senator Sanders about, but my first major concern is that in the name of compromise, the president may go along with some of this horrible legislation that the Republicans come up with, much like Bill Clinton did with the repeal of Glass-Steagall and the welfare reform.
Mm-hmm.
And my second major concern is that the Republicans will just, you know, attach all kinds of mischievous riders on must-pass legislation. And, you know, if we're not vigilant, we're not even going to know what happened, much like what happened with the post office.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Until
plan on it, Anita.
Right.
Plan on it. The one obstacle to that is the president's ability to veto legislation.
Well, yeah, I understand that. But if it's must pass, we're right. going to have to really be vigilant and make a big, you know,
yeah.
a lot of noise.
I agree. And make a lot of noise and point in the direction of the White House. I absolutely agree. It's what's the old Chinese curse? You know, may you live in interesting times. Here we are. So we're just going to have to keep an eye on that. But you raise a really important point. Thank you very much for the call, Anita. It's great to hear from you. Jared in Burlington, Vermont. Hey, Jared. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV.
Tom, thank you very much for taking my call. And I've always enjoyed your program greatly.
Thank you.
I have two bites of the apple, if I may. I'll make them brief. One, you talk a great deal about the Scandinavian countries and the various social programs that they have.
Mm-hmm.
How in the world can we think about having something like that in the States when we spend 60% of our budget on the military and 40% on everything else? The other thing that bothers me a great deal is the Cuban Revolution in 60 or 61, I think it was 61.
It's 59.
All right, thank you. Anyway,
Jared?
One of the reasons that Batista was thrown out, one of the reasons was that he was backed by the United States, and he's sort of, you know, the gringo of the North.
Yeah.
The other thing is that American companies were taking tremendous advantage of Cuba. And,
right.
You know, certainly Citibank, certainly AT&T.
Jared, we're running out of time. Your point?
My point is we're doing the same thing again.
Where?
American industries are lining up to go to Cuba and do the same thing that happened before.
Yeah. Batista had been running a police state, though, on behalf of the mafia, basically. I mean, it was far more corrupt than I can think of anything out there right now that we're involved with. So... But I get what you're saying. I mean, you know, this is the danger of transnational corporations and capitalism. Jared, thanks for the call. Good, great point. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Harbin here with you, and Anything Goes Friday. John in Carbondale, Illinois. Hey, John, what's up? John, you are on the air. Okay, I'm not hearing John. Let's try Reggie in Salem, Arkansas. Hey, Reggie, you are on the air. Do you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Great.
Listen, I am new to Social Security, and I become eligible for Medicare the 1st of January. So I have been trying to find a drug program that I guess I have to have. My assets are enough so that I don't qualify for any low-income programs.
Mm-hmm.
But my three bottles of insulin that I need a month are more than I make on my Social Security. So I have been to every drug program seminar. I have talked to my pharmacist, and the best suggestion that anybody has ever made or has made in order for me to pay for my drugs that I need is get a divorce.
Hmm.
My husband is disabled. He's in a wheelchair. He's an amputee. He's a veteran. And between him and I, we struggled together. And, you know, we've been married for 30 years. We're not really interested in a divorce, but we don't know what else to do.
Wow.
Yeah, those bottles of insulin are over $300 a piece.
Right. This should not be in the United States, Reggie. It should not be in the richest nation in the world that people, that retired people have to get a divorce in order to be able to pay for their pharmaceuticals.
And it's becoming, you know, according to the pharmacist, he's had quite a few people that have had to do this. So
just us. I've heard the stories. Yeah, I've absolutely heard the stories. You talk about perverse incentives, you know, programs that have the consequence that's very different from what's rational. I don't have a solution for you, Reggie. Thank you for raising it as a really important issue. And maybe somebody will call in with a suggestion for you as the program goes on. I hope so. But I just don't. I'm not an expert on these things. Thank you for the call, though. Middleton in Ono, Washington, or West Virginia, rather. Hey, Middleton, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom.
Hi.
I was wanting to talk to Bernie about that issue that I brought up with him before when I talked to him. It has to do with the pre-existing conditions and the Medicare supplement insurance program.
Yeah, but he's not here right now. He's not here right now.
I know. I was going to read him the provision in the Affordable Care Act where it gives the insurance companies that insures Medicare to deny you coverage.
Mm-hmm.
They ask you the questions. They got questions, pre-existing questions they ask you. And I was going to read him this provision of the Affordable Care Act that exempts the Medicare insurance program.
Right. I would suggest that you if you want to communicate that to Bernie Middleton, I would suggest that you contact his office. They're very accessible. They take, you know, they've got people who actually answer the phone. A lot of members of Congress just have answering machines. And they've got a very active website as well at sanders.senate.gov. Thanks for the call. Andrea in Manitou Springs, Colorado. Hey, Andrea, what's on your mind today?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Everyone's been talking about the cuts for seniors and, you know, what a shame it is that they're living off of $10,000, $14,000 a year.
Right.
But in my experience, it seems like that older generation, they continue to vote conservative. They're voting against their own best interests. And not only does it affect them, I'm 24. I make, I think, $12,000 or $13,000 a year full-time trying to go to school, trying to start my life. And unfortunately, their voting affects my life as well as their benefits. And it's, you know, I just wanted to know what you thought about that, because we were talking, I think Bernie was saying earlier, that not enough young people are voting. But I feel like part of the problem is that a lot of the older generation is voting, but they're voting, I'm sorry to say it, but wrong.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Well, if the average age of people watching Fox so-called news is 71, if I'm remembering correctly. And people listening to conservative talk radio on average, if you listen to the ads on those shows, they tend to be the Geritol type of ads, you know, the ads, diapers for older people kind of ads. And you know, so Yeah, I mean, there's an enormous right wing PR offensive directed at my father's generation, or even my generation, the Boomer generation, and it catches a fair number of them. The Tea Party is largely a Boomer phenomenon. On the other hand, people your age, Andrea, are not showing up to vote in anything close to the numbers that they were just 30 years ago. And
right.
And I think it's, you know, Senator Sanders talked to this. He says it's because people get it that our democracy is not working. Our country's not working. The game is rigged, as Elizabeth Warren says. And so why bother voting? And we've got to change that dynamic.
Yeah, and you had actually talked to my fiance Keenan before, and I think he was asking, you know, what young people can do. And this morning we were talking about, you know, what country is going to be the new America, the country where people are going to immigrate so that they can start businesses and lives, because this country isn't it anymore.
Yeah, increasingly it's Europe. There was a great article that was written by one of the economist guys called The New European Dream, that the American dream has died and now it's the European dream. Particularly Northern Europe. Andrea, thanks for the call. Thanks for listening, and thanks for sharing our message, the message, with your generation.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We all need to be reaching out to young people in very significant ways and bring them into the political process. There's a lot of alienation out there. The bad, the very, very pot, valiantly ugly, the good. Governor Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington State, has proposed using a carbon tax to fight CO2 emissions in his state. Inslee's plan, which was announced on Tuesday, would require Washington's biggest polluters to do what everyone else in the world already has to do, pay to take out their own trash. According to initial estimates, the governor's proposed carbon tax would raise $4.8 billion over the next 12 years. And most of that money would be spent to help rebuild roads and jumpstart sustainability initiatives. Sounds like a plan. Let's just hope the rest of the country is paying attention. The bad. Rafael Cruz. During a public appearance earlier this fall, the father of Texas Senator Ted Cruz blasted marriage equality in language that was, well, suggestive. Seriously, check it out.
Let me tell you this. Government legislates morality all the time. The problem is, if it is the wicked that are governing, what they are legislating is their immorality. And they are cramming it down our throats.
That's right. They're cramming it down our throats. Some jokes just write themselves. And the very, very ugly, Rikers Island. The infamous New York City prison is now the subject of a federal lawsuit for its treatment of teenage inmates. Lawsuit alleges that Rikers Island fostered a, quote, pervasive and deep-seated culture of violence, end quote, against its inmates. Comes just a few months after a Justice Department report found that teenage prisoners at Rikers are routinely beaten and often kept in cages during periods of solitary confinement. Remember, this is the Justice Department saying this stuff, not some super liberal activist organization. There's no reason that anyone, let alone teenagers, should be subjected to this kind of treatment ever. Whether they're guilty of breaking the law or not, it's a clear violation of the Eighth Amendment. That they were subject to this kind of treatment, well, that's very eerie. You know, there's interesting, Valerie Tarico wrote a piece over on Alternet. Why is rape, she says, at the origin of most religion? And she says, stories like the virgin birth lack freely given female consent. Why don't they bother us more? Maybe it's because of the milieu that I grew up in, or the religion I grew up in, or the time that I grew up. But it had never occurred to me before I read this piece, that the story of Christmas is a story of God raping Mary. You know, she became pregnant. Didn't want to be, didn't plan on it. And it was God's baby. That's pretty strange. It's an interesting topic. We'll do more on this at some point. I want to share more of that piece with you. But today's Anything Goes Friday, so we'll toss it off to you guys. John in Carbondale, Illinois. Hey, John, thanks for watching. What's up?
Yes, I was watching a conservative TV show last night, and a very famous economist, his last name is Laffer, was on, famous for the Laffer curve.
Yeah, Art Laffer, yes.
Art Laffer, thank you. I couldn't think of his first name. Well, I'd heard about him for the last 20 or 30 years. And he contends and says he's got much data to back it up that if you lower the tax rate on the rich, the government will collect more tax revenue from them.
Right.
And what is your take on that?
Art Laffer is famous as an economist for being wrong. Mind-bogglingly wrong. He convinced Ronald Reagan to do that, and Ronald Reagan, as a consequence of that, tripled the federal deficit. Ronald Reagan borrowed more money during his 8 years as president as a consequence of dropping the top tax rate from 74% to 28% on really, truly rich people. Reagan ran up more debt than every president from George Washington to Jimmy Carter combined. And, you know, it's mind-boggling the debt we went into. Sam Brownback tried this in Kansas 2 years ago. He said, I'm going to do what Art Laffer says, and we're going to cut taxes on rich people. The Koch brothers, by the way, live in Kansas. And he cut state taxes on all these people, saying, get ready, all the money's going to come in. And what happened is Kansas's entire budget right now is in crisis, and Kansas is going to have to take Obamacare money just to keep their budget in balance. I mean, Sam Brownback has just devastated that state. He nearly lost his reelection as governor. I mean, he was, as a consequence of this. So Art Laffer is frankly a fool. He is a shill for billionaires and rich people, a very well-paid shill for them, I'm assuming. He's still around, and he's wrong. I've had these debates with these guys before, including Art Laffer, who's been on this program a couple of times. And although it's been probably 6 years since he was on. And what they will say is, oh, look at, you know, after Reagan cut top tax rates, tax revenues increased. Well, tax revenues increase every year because the economy grows. You know, the more people are born, there's more activity, there's inflation, tax revenues always increase. It has nothing to do with Art Laffer and his crazy ideas. So, John, I just, you know, do not take this guy seriously. If you want to read a good critique of his work, I would recommend to you David K. Johnston's writings, among others. There's some really, really good just takedowns of Art Laffer and basically Reaganomics. What he's promoting is trickle-down economics. John, thanks for the call. Wendy in Parkland, Florida. Hey, Wendy.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to get back to the medical marijuana issue.
Oh, perfect. I'm drinking my hemp milk right now.
Good. Well, that's actually what prompted my call, because you were talking about the hemp milk being a placebo for your back pain.
Yeah.
And I am into medicinal mushrooms. I don't know if you've heard anything about medicinal mushrooms, but they are an alternative to marijuana that's perfectly legal, perfectly safe, and they will address a lot of these health issues that people are trying to address with.
Right, you're talking about
marijuana.
Things like turkey tail.
I'm talking about the Lingji mushroom, which is also known as the Reishi mushroom.
Right.
There are a lot of different varieties, and the supplements that I use will combine different medicinal mushrooms to achieve their goal. But
right.
Basically. If for pain, you know, if it's a major anti-inflammatory, and the way that mushrooms work, they're adaptogens, and they kind of sense the areas in your body that are toxic or stressed or injured or damaged, and they focus their healing potency where it's needed. So, like for me, I started using it because I have a thyroid disease. And I've been able to stay off of Synthroid because my thyroid is now functioning. And when I go for my scans, I actually have fewer nodules than I did the time before.
Hmm.
Pretty
That's
amazing
great.
Stuff.
Yeah. And hypothyroidism is pr- probably the most widely diagnosed disease in America. I know that Synthroid is the most widely prescribed drug in America. That's fascinating. Yeah, Louise really got us into, and for people who are listening, we're not talking about psychedelic mushrooms here. We're not talking about psilocybin and those kind of things. We're talking about just, you know, mushrooms that have healing potential or capabilities. Paul Stamets is the expert on this. He's been on our show a number of times. In fact, we had him on the TV show just a few weeks ago. And he has started a company. He sells a really great line of products, mushroom products. Louise has bought some of these, turkey tail in particular, which is very anti-cancer, by the pound. I mean, you know, just, you know, making up her own formulas and putting them in food and things like that. So I'm with you. I think that there's a lot of potential there. Wendy, thanks for calling and pointing it out. George in Chicago. Hey, George, fascism in America?
Yeah, it's still alive and well, as we all know, but I just wanted to venture back to, I think it was about a week and a half or so ago, you read from an op-ed that former Vice President Henry Wallace wrote in the New York Times in the 40s.
Yes.
About the nature of fascism in America. And I'm sure that he wrote that with a full knowledge of the fascist plot in the 30s that was derailed by General Smedley Butler and was investigated by a congressional committee.
Yes.
And I just wanted to let you know that War is a Racket by General Butler is now back in print.
Oh, great. I'm surprised it ever went out of print.
Yeah, I had, because of hearing about the book on your show, I had tried to purchase the book at Hughes bookstores, and they had a hard time running down a copy around the country. So I said, well, I'll buy one new, and they told me, well, nobody's printing it. But there's now a company in Port Townsend, Washington called Farrell House, F-E-R-A-L, Farrell House Publishers, that is printing it, and it's available for $10.
Great.
With some additional material. So
great.
It's out there. Go to your favorite bookstore. One other thing I'd like to mention, that you also talked about this. I first ran across this in an unauthorized biography of George W. Bush called Fortunate Son.
Oh, yeah. That's a great book.
Investigation of Bush and Walker family assets during World War II because they were trading with the enemy.
Right, and Brown Brother Harriman. Yeah.
The companies that were confiscated were taken away from them, and the people involved were fined $1,500,000, which in early to mid-40s money was a substantial amount, probably $15 million in today's money.
Right, and Prescott Bush nearly got prosecuted. Roosevelt was very, very angry. He was a senator at the time, as I recall. And Franklin Roosevelt was very, very upset with him about that. George, and Fortunate Son is one of the very best biographies of George W. Bush. George, thank you very much for the call. We will be back. It's Hatfield, I think, wrote Fortunate Son.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That was the book. Fortunate Son was, if my memory is serving me correctly, was the book that identified Bush and his cocaine problems. And the author died shortly after he wrote the book. Welcome back. Winston in Ormond Beach, Florida. Hey, Winston. Thanks for watching Facebook TV on Dish.
Dr. Hartman.
Hey.
My reason for calling is you mentioned about the Fox News, the demographics of Fox News is about that listen to it is around 71. And I'm 71, and I hate the station. I can't even stand it. But the thing that bothers me is that these people that are 71 around in that age, they've got complete amnesia as to the way things were. I mean, they had things given to them. They took advantage. We took advantage of all the different social things. We went to college free. We had all these advantages. You could buy a house. You could do all kinds of stuff. They were social. And, you know, and they got amnesia about the kids working today. We paid 15 cents a gallon for gas. I can remember my first fuel bill was $6.50. My first bill for gas and electric was $6.50. And the wife didn't have to work. And now you hear them talking about, oh, I work hard. I work my tail off, and I did this, did that. And, you know, it's like these people don't do the same thing, but they don't have the same benefits we had.
Yeah.
You know, and we live good. And I think about it, and it just troubles me to no end how these people can get complete amnesia, vote against their own interests, vote against the kids' interests, and not care.
Yeah. It's a testimonial, Winston, to the extraordinary power of media. You know, Fox, so-called news, has done a great job of convincing people that up is down. I mean, it's truly astonishing, you know, what they have to say every day. If you go over to MediaMatters.org, literally every day they're debunking a new lie that Fox News is promoting. And they do it shamelessly over there. And then it migrates from Fox News to all the right-wing, you know, talk shows, and then to right-wing publications, and then shows up in the right-wing internet. And then when campaigns roll around, you get right-wing billionaires who run big ads that basically reinforce these, oh, Benghazi, IRS, you know, quack, 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 scandal, 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 Obama. And they make sure that nobody ever discusses on Fox News or on right-wing radio or whatever the fact that the boomers, the you know, our generation essentially, you know, had a damn good life when we were young in the 50s and 60s and 70s and even the early 80s until Reaganomics started taking effect. And it was a golden age in the history of America. And what took it down was Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm. Can I also interject one more thing, Tom?
Yeah.
When back in the day, we were all bohemians, hippies and whatnot, and we fought for love and war and fought against the war and everything else, and we turned out to be the greediest people on the planet. If you look at who's got all the money, now they've made it. We've made a lot of money. I've made a lot of money in my life.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're doing well. I'm retired. And you think about all the wealth that these people, all these people that were given all this stuff and the wealth.
Yeah.
And they, like I say, they got amnesia. They don't remember a thing. And, Tom, thank you for your time.
Thanks a lot, Winston. Yeah, as I was walking down the dock this morning, I was thinking about how, you know, Richard Mellon Scaife, he inherited his money. I mean, he funded all these right-wing enterprises for years and years, helped start the Heritage Foundation. Joe Coors inherited his money. I'm pretty sure he did. I think his father started Coors Brewery. The Koch brothers inherited their money from their daddy. I mean, they added a lot to it, but, you know, they inherited a fossil fuel empire from daddy. And it's like, where are the truly right-wing billionaires who didn't inherit their money from daddy? Donald Trump, you know, got his money from daddy. It's your media support group for We the People, the Tom Hartman Program. Let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, for the news of the day, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Bob Ney, former Congressman Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, the book that you have to read if you want to know how Washington, D.C. works, on the line with us. Hey, Bob.
Hello, Tom. All I inherited today was the news.
Okay, so what's in the news?
Well, you know, the Cuba thing, Tom, is fascinating. Now, the president is, and of course, we're awaiting a press conference right now. Victoria Jones normally would be doing your show. She's there waiting for the president for his year-end conference. But the president is moving very quickly and in all kinds of very true, legitimate ways. He'll be able to ease some agriculture exports, establish some banking regulations. The Commerce Department will move to allow U.S. companies to export construction and telecommunications equipment. And that's just a few to name of what the president is going to be able to do. Now, on the other hand, the GOP, now there are some members on the Democratic side, but mainly the GOP is, quote, plotting to stop President Obama. And the best, really, that they can do right now is they're going to try to, you know, block an ambassadorship. And the quote by Speaker John Boehner is, relations with the Castro regime should not be revisited, let alone normalized. But again, I think that as we start to see a split in the Cuban community itself in Florida, which there is between the young and the old, on this issue of reuniting. And as you see, one of the first 2016ers, Rand Paul, coming out in a different direction. Jeff Flake, extremely, as you know, conservative, right-wing Tea Party guy from Arizona, is on the side of the president on this. So there's going to be some fractures.
Mm-hmm.
One thing, Tom, that we're seeing and picking up today in D.C. is that some of the Republicans, mainly, you know, Senator Rubio and Ted Cruz, et cetera, are starting to believe they can actually make this a cause of the day and try to carry this on ad nauseum month after month. And
it ain't going to work.
I'm sorry, what's that?
I said it ain't going to work.
No. In fact, it will be counter to the Republicans. It will really take them off any type of track of an agenda that they could put forth, you know, hoping to capture the imagination of people for the presidential election.
Yeah.
But it will not work.
Wasn't it in my conversation with you yesterday that I talked about the older Cubans that I was interviewing in the 90s?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it was either I listened to it because I listened before I come on, but now I think we talked. You had interviewed, you had interviewed older Cubans. You did this.
And they were all talking about, I want my property back. I want my house back. I want my business back. When Castro falls, I'm going to get it back. Those guys are all dead now. And the new generation knows that they have no claims to anything in Cuba. But they would just like to reconnect with their family, with their ancestral homeland, whatever, you know, and I think that this is really a generational cleavage, Bob.
It is. And again, a lot of the younger Cubans don't have that, you know, fierce recall of trying to fight Castro for 50 years. They have relatives, some of which most of them have not seen them. They can't send appropriate amounts of money over to them to help them out because that's been blocked for years, which all goes back to hurting the Cuban people. I've also noticed a lot of interesting items about cars and, you know, different, I think, positive stories about Cuba that you're starting to see in the media. So I really don't think that if they try to rally the GOP side around, stop Obama, you know, he's dealing with dictators, they're going to have to kind of start looking at China first.
So yeah.
I don't think it's going to work.
Yeah, China, Vietnam, I mean, you know, take your pick.
Exactly.
Yep.
And I know Sony's at the forefront of everything, but I did want to mention this off of Sony for a second because, you know, it's got a lot of debate to it. But the IRS, this temporary shutdown possibility, and the Internal Revenue Service is considering its own temporary shutdown, and that would be due to the recent budget cuts enacted, of course, by the Congress, and they are calling it furloughs.
Right.
And again, the IRS Commissioner John Koskinen said and clarified today that it would be, quote, the last option, you know, that they would exercise.
Right.
But
they're trying to keep people employed.
Commissioner has warned employees in an email that overtime would be suspended, hiring freezes enacted, et cetera. And, of course, the budget, as we know, was cut $346 million, and that was a, you know, thumb the nose at the agency that, quote, got the, you know, right-wing groups, et cetera, et cetera. But the irony of it is that the Republicans, in doing that, as you know, Tom, will be cutting their nose off because a lot of fraud will not be looked at.
Well, I think the Republicans actually like that. I've had conservatives on this show say that they're in favor of tax fraud.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. That the system is corrupt. That the IRS has no business doing what it's doing. It acts like a dictatorial agency. And tax fraud is a revolutionary and patriotic thing. I've actually, yeah. Yeah, it's bizarre, but it's there.
It is bizarre, quite bizarre. And the other thing in the news, too, and I know you've covered this story, but former Governor Don Siegelman, you know, was denied bail from prison. And as I understand it, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals is going to hear his case again in January, I believe.
Yes, around the middle of January is my understanding.
And, of course, there was the misconduct by Lura Canary, who was President George Bush's nominee for the U.S. Attorney for the Middle District of Alabama.
Right, and whose husband was the campaign manager for Don Siegelman's opponent, Bob Riley.
Yes, and not trying to be self-satisfying in any way on this, but I wrote a chapter in my book, Sideswiped, because I found the case of Don Siegelman of anybody either side of the aisle to be the most unbelievable travesty of justice I think I've seen since, you know, I was old enough to read.
Yeah, totally agree. It was a purely political prosecution. Bob Canary, I believe his name was Bob, Laura Canary's husband who ran Bob Riley's campaign, was Karl Rove's best friend when they were in college and growing up together, when Karl Rove grew up in Alabama.
Right.
I mean, it's just the whole story stinks to high heaven. But, you know, Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, his book Sideswiped, a great holiday gift. Thank you, Bob, for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Great talking with you. And we'll be back. Tom Shadyac is going to drop by for a few minutes, the director of Bruce Almighty, Ace Ventura, Patch Adams, and The Nutty Professor, about a new movie that's going to be playing on Free Speech TV this next week. And then we'll continue with Anything Goes Friday.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you on this beautiful Friday, the 19th of December. Tom Shadyac on the line with us, the award-winning director of Bruce Almighty, Ace Ventura, Patch Adams, The Nutty Professor, and his most recent, I believe his most recent, I Am. And the website is I Am The Doc, as in documentary. I Am The Doc. THEDOC.com is the website. And I Am, this movie that Tom Shadyac produced and essentially stars in, is going to be playing in this upcoming week on Free Speech TV, Dish and Direct and cable systems around the country and on the internet. You go to freespeech.org or, you know, it's probably the best for showtimes and information. Tom Shadyac. Hey, Tom, welcome back to the program. It's been a while.
Tom, how are you? And you neglected to mention that you also star in the movie I Am. So I've worked with some of the sexiest leading men in Hollywood, and that includes you.
Well,
so
thank you, sir.
Yeah, you were wonderful in the movie. And I think the time it's playing is Saturday. I think it's playing this Saturday, December 20th at 8 o'clock Eastern time. That's what I was told.
Great. So that would be tomorrow.
Yeah.
Tomorrow.
Yeah. Great. Tomorrow.
And
yeah.
With just a little bit of tweaking, it could become a classic Christmas movie because it's really this essential story about what is the meaning of life. It was your search for the meaning of life after a horrible biking accident.
You know, I actually, you know, take that at face value because I liken it to It's a Wonderful Life, where George Bailey learns, of course, that he became wealthy because he created community. And that's what I woke up to in my own life, that there was a kind of wealth that my society had not emphasized, which is the wealth that comes with being a part of uplifting others. And I hope inspires people to see that value in their own lives.
Yeah, yeah. Tell our viewers and listeners, not everybody is familiar with your movie, I Am. Which will be playing tomorrow at, what did you say, 8 p.m. Eastern?
Yeah, 8 p.m. Eastern.
On Free Speech TV, and you can, and if you don't have Free Speech TV on your television, you can watch it on the internet at freespeech.org. For people who are not familiar with us, you want to give us the elevator pitch?
Well, the elevator pitch, I call it the ultimate reality show, because the idea of reality is to see things as they are, and I don't think our society has been crafted around the way things actually are. So it started when I had a bike accident a few years ago, and I got a bad concussion that led to post-concussion syndrome, and I nearly died. And I had, over the course of attaining quote-unquote success, I had woken up to certain ideas. I got the American dream, if you will, and it felt a bit empty. It didn't pay. It didn't bring the fulfillment that I was promised. The good life was not as good as I was told. And I started to see things through a different prism. And I went out and explored that idea of what has gone wrong with our world and what can we do about it. So I talked to folks like yourself who have been looking into the social ills and the fixes. And I wanted to reduce it down to some very simple principles. And you woke me up to an idea, Tom, that became one of the center points of the movie, which is this idea of Wetiko, which is a Native American idea that we're all living under a kind of mental illness. where we take all that we can take. This is you were talking about the economy while I was on hold. And so much of what I think has gone wrong, Martin Luther King talked about extensively, Gandhi talked about extensively, is we uplift people who take more than they need. And, of course, that's not a value reflected in nature. It's not a value reflected by our moral leaders. And I did the same, and I was uplifted by my society and told, you are now a winner. And I think in many ways it was a very hollow victory. And now I feel, again, much more happy, more robust in my life because I'm sharing what comes in. I'm helping to create community. I'm helping to provide opportunities for others. And I'm trying to be that change that I want to see in the world. But there was an idea, again, that you woke me up to. You know, I had to write the movie as I went because I was making discoveries, and you taught me about this mental illness. When the Native Americans saw this this European idea coming, this Western idea coming, that we just take indiscriminately, regardless of need, and they called it a mental illness, and I agree.
Brilliant. Tom, last time we talked, you had, well, and in the movie, actually, you show everybody this extraordinary multi-million-dollar mansion that you had. I mean, you were a famous, are a famous director. You basically made the career of Jim Carrey, in my opinion. I don't know if you would agree with that, but, you know, you had all these movies, Ace Ventura, Patch Adams, Nutty Professor, Bruce Almighty.
Yeah, why not? Jim, I made you, buddy. Jim is incredibly talented, but I helped.
Yeah, and the consequence of that was that you made a pile of money. You made millions of dollars. And in the movie, in I Am, you walk us through that mansion, and then you essentially say you're giving that up. How's it going now?
It's going good. I'm still in process. People flash the headline that I moved to a mobile home, you know, and they that's a way of dismissing my journey. This was not a about giving things up, but about discovering things that were more powerful. And the mobile home park that I moved to, it costs a lot of money to live there. It's a much simpler way of life. It's only about 1,000 square feet, these mobile homes, but it is a beautiful place. And again, it costs money. And I didn't feel I gave anything up. I met neighbors. I created community. And I'm still a work in progress. I've given away much of the funds that have come in, you know. And again, I feel infinitely wealthy for it. Like George Bailey, you know, at the end of It's a Wonderful Life, to talk about that Christmas movie, he said, I'm the richest man in town. And I feel like that quite often.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, you know, it's been 20, 30 years since I saw It's a Wonderful Life. I don't remember does it take place around Christmas? I mean, is it overtly a Christmas movie, or have we simply adopted it as one because the message is so uplifting?
Well, it's right around Christmas, and yes, no, it's there's scenes of snow and Christmas lights.
But, oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah, you're right.
Yeah. But it is, boy, I mean, if you really look at that movie, it really speaks well to, it's a revolutionary idea. I mean, George Bailey, you know, supposed to live this life of travel and excess and luxury and privilege, and he gives it all up to help his neighbors, to essentially allow them to build homes at rates that they couldn't afford by other lending institutions. So he doesn't make a lot of money, but he ends up to be, of course, the wealthiest person in town because he's helped to uplift others.
The original good bankster.
Yeah, exactly.
It's an amazing concept.
And unfortunately, Potter, you remember Potter's the sort of the arch, you know,
the
anti-hero.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's what we put on covers of magazines today. If you're Potter, you know, and you've pulled out, you know, billions and more, you're who we say, hey, kids, grow up and be like him. And we just got it upside down. And I think the reason I think the film I Am speaks to people is they already know this stuff. They know that we can't continue this way. They know that something's gone wrong. It's not about 99 versus 1%. It's about all of us recognizing that there's just a healthier way to live, more equitable way to live.
Especially in the richest nation on earth, the fact that, you know, 1 in 4 of our children lives in poverty, that, you know, 1 out of 20 of our children at some point in the last year did not, you know, went to bed hungry. I mean, this is bizarre stuff for the richest nation on earth.
Yeah. And, you know, if we were having incredible outcomes in terms of happiness and healthy lifestyles amongst the wealthy, then it would be one thing. And I can report that, you know, being one of those in the Petri dish, the experiment of happiness, that the more I had given to others. And again, I'm giving myself what I need. Whatever I need, I'm able to give myself.
Sure.
But the more that you involve yourself in a community and uplifting others and providing opportunities for others, the more happy you get.
There you go.
And we see it all over in terms of happiness studies. We are not the happiest country in the world. And other countries are doing things that I think we're slowly catching up to.
Very well said. Tom Shadyac, I Am the Doc, the documentary. IamTheDoc.com is the website. The movie will be 8 o'clock tomorrow night on Saturday on Free Speech TV.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Tom Shadyac, thanks so much for being with us, Tom.
I love you, Tom. Take care, brother.
Great talking with you. Thank you, sir. Back at you. We'll be right back. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Laura in Richmond, Ohio. Hey, Laura, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. What's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. A few weeks ago, you made a comment about the people in charge, the 1%, the 3%, are the people who have the power. And I disagree with you.
Okay.
I think the people who have the power are the working people. They just don't know it.
I agree with that statement.
I think there's a way that that can come about.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be well organized. But I think that given time, I don't mean that this should happen right now, but given time and letting people know, all those who make, say, less than $50,000 a year would join in the cause. And maybe a year from now, 8, 10, 12 months from now, you have a walkout. And I don't mean for one day. I mean for a week, 2 weeks, however long it takes to get not a minimum of 10, but 25.
Right.
40 hours a week and maybe $20 a week $20 an hour for anyone working less than 32 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
I think it can be done. Not by me.
Well, if our pay had kept up with the productivity of our workforce, which is the way it was from the George Washington administration until the Reagan administration, as companies and individual workers became more productive, in part through technology and things like that, and but also through the, you know, improvements, their pay went up. And ever since Reagan, productivity has continued to rise at the same rate it had in the 100 years preceding that. But pay has been flat and, in fact, is declining now for working people. So I think you're absolutely right. And if pay had kept up with productivity, right now the minimum wage would be in the neighborhood of $24 an hour. So $25 an hour is not that unrealistic.
Yes, and I think it can be done. I think there are enough good people out there who could organize something and get it going. It would give anybody that would take part enough time to be able to cover whatever time is out of work so that they don't suffer, and then have a group of people who would be our mediators with those people that own the big companies.
Mm-hmm.
I think we have to do something because it can't go on the way it is.
Well, this is a role, Laura, that unions used to play, but the Republicans since Reagan launched his war on organized labor in 81, busting PATCO, we've gone from 33% union 35% union representation down to 8%. It's just the Republican Party has destroyed unionization in this country. So that's something that needs to come back as well, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
That was the biggest mistake this country made when they allowed them to destroy the unions.
Yep. And I'd say in 47 when Taft-Hartley was passed over Harry Truman's veto, and then they passed it over his veto, that was the original, one of the original really terrible Republican crimes against this republic. Laura, thank you for the call, and thank you for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Well, Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Oh, this is interesting. Tom is wrong. Hydrocodone is the most widely prescribed drug in the U.S., not Synthroid. That's amazing. That's a BS man in the chat room pointing this out. That's astonishing. And by the way, the young people have the highest rates of poverty. Kids have, young people have, and the lowest poverty rate is among older people. That's true, but that's also in large part because about a third of elderly people are lifted out of poverty by Social Security. So, and there's no Social Security analog for people in their 20s. And there should be. It should be called free college education. And it used to be in the United States. Bob in Clifton, Tennessee. Hey, Bob, anything goes Friday. What's on your mind?
Well, hello, Tom. You know, we spoke recently about Anthony Romero's idea of a pardon for George W. Bush and his crime family.
Right.
And I disagreed with you because I certainly want to see them prosecuted. However, I realize that a pardon would only be valid in the United States, and they would still be subject to prosecution internationally. So I've come around and modified it, but I would like to extend this idea a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Obama commuted sentences of 8 men who had life terms for drug crimes this week and gave 12 pardons for people who had completed their sentences.
Mm-hmm.
My feeling is that the President of the United States could issue a blanket pardon for all felons who have served their sentences and any probation and do not have any pending charges outstanding or current. This would re-enfranchise the black people who have disproportionately been denied their right to vote in this democratic republic. And thus, and because of that, they've lost a vital civil voice.
Mm-hmm.
And 1/8 are ineligible to vote, according to the Sentencing Project.
Right.
And I think this would strike a blow against white privilege, which is largely responsible, along with the institutional and historic racism, so that we would re-enfranchise the people who have lost their right to vote by being felons, if the president would issue a blanket pardon for those who have completed their sentences.
Well, I've been looking for the in Article 2, Section 2, Sentence 1. I just found it. Whether the president would have the power to give a blanket pardon. And it says,
yep,
he shall have the power to grant reprieves and pardons for offenses against the United States, except in cases of impeachment. So he can only issue a pardon for somebody who has been convicted in federal court, if I'm reading that right. Although I don't know. Has the president ever pardoned somebody who was convicted in state court? I honestly don't know that, the answer to that question. But whether to do a blanket pardon like you're describing, Bob, if my reading of the Constitution is correct, and it may well be wrong, I mean, it might have been modified over the years by Supreme Court decisions or whatever, then it wouldn't be possible to give a blanket pardon. A, it would have to be specific individuals, and B, you couldn't do it over state crimes. Say what, Shano? Yeah, Shano says he just checked the Department of Justice's website, and they say only federal crimes can be pardoned by the president. So,
well, that would be a beginning.
It would be a beginning, and it would establish a good precedent. And if he were to do it and call on attorneys general, or governors, rather. Most governors have the power to commute sentences and pardon people to behave similarly in their states. Of course, it's not going to happen in the red states, and it's principally red states where once your felony conviction, after you get out of jail and after you get off probation, that you still can't vote. That's mostly red states. So it's, you know, they're going to continue doing their new Jim Crow thing as long as they possibly can. But good point, Bob. Very good point. Thanks for the call. Giovanni in Hadley, Mass. Hey, Giovanni. Thanks for listening to 96.9 FM. What's up?
Hello?
Hey, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Me and my coworkers at work listen to you on a daily basis, and we always get caught up in conversation afterwards.
Cool.
I was listening to your show yesterday, this morning, and something dawned on me while you were talking to Pastor Brian. You know, the Republicans, they're using that whole religion concept to justify their torture and their means to get information, but that kind of goes against, well, actually, it immediately goes against something that this country was founded on. And we have a Declaration of Independence in our store. I read it every now and again. What happened to the whole idea of separation from church and state? That
right.
being said, we're still running a country based off a document written in 1700. We're about to be in the year 2015. I think we need a revamp of this country's founding principles altogether, because we've just strayed so far away from them.
Yeah, the clearest example of how we have held to an anachronism in the face of purely as a consequence of a very, very wealthy industry is the Second Amendment, and how it has been treated as holy writ. And the consequence of that is that the United States has more gun deaths than any other country in the world on a per capita basis, and probably in absolute numbers as well. And very, very well, maybe not any country in the world. There's probably some that are at war, but we've got this horrible, horrible mess. On the other hand, there's some really good founding principles in our Constitution. I'm very worried about a constitutional convention right now with the oligarchs running the show.
Well, yeah, that's right. If it does happen, if there is this kind of revamp, it can't be with the way the government's kind of straying towards one side, you know?
Yeah.
And
well,
like the girl who called earlier, who's only 24, I'm only 21. Our entire generation is the generation that either is too lazy or too preoccupied to actively participate in this kind of stuff, or it's the complete opposite end of the spectrum where we're out there protesting, we're out there speaking our minds, but there's just not enough of us.
Yeah. Or option three, y'all are working your butts off and scared to death of the college debt. I mean, it's all these things. Giovanni, thank you for the call.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
We'll be back. It's Anything Goes Friday here on the Tom Hartman Program. Stick around. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And remarkable. Eugene Debs, 1904, Socialist Party. Fascinating stuff. I was just reading this New York Times article about Bernie Sanders running for president by Cheryl Gay-Stolberg, and she said he is certainly the only potential candidate, talking about Bernie, to carry a brass keychain from a campaign of Eugene V. Debs, a five-time Socialist Party nominee for president. I didn't know that either. It's fascinating. Eugene Debs is quite a character. Anyhow, John, it's Anything Goes Friday. John in Palm Springs, California, a woman called earlier and said that she had been advised to divorce her husband in order to be able to pay for her meds. You had a suggestion. Thanks for listening to 1450 AM in Palm Springs.
Yeah, thank you. I'm a first-time caller, a long-time listener to your wonderful program.
Thank you, John.
I wasn't clear whether the lady had already gotten into the Medicare program or not, but if she hasn't gotten in yet, because the open enrollment period has stopped, she should really check the Medicare Advantage options. I'm in a similar situation. I would not be able to afford my health care because of Social Security being on disability. And I actually got onto it years before the actual retirement age. But when I got onto Medicare, I looked at the Advantage programs, and there are some that are run by commercial insurance companies. I would tend to not go with those. Oftentimes, there are those that are run by nonprofit insurance companies, and that's one I chose. Hmm. And it turns out that it was one of the highest rated Medicare Advantage programs, and it was also the lowest cost Medicare Advantage program in the Palm Springs area.
Hmm.
And it includes your Part D drug coverage. I don't pay anything for doctor's visits. I've had numerous MRIs. I've had numerous x-rays. I've had numerous blood tests. I have paid $0 every single time. My drugs, if it's a generic, a preferred generic, it's $0. If it's a non-preferred generic, it's $3. If I have to go to a brand name because generics are not available, a preferred brand is $25 a month, and a non-preferred is more expensive, $80 a month. Yeah. But again, it covers pre-existing conditions don't make any difference. In many of the cases, and most of the cases, you don't pay anything extra for the Advantage program. Some people don't like it because it is an HMO, and you're stuck with just a prearranged group of doctors. But she may even have her doctor already enrolled in one of those programs. That's something that she could find out.
That's a good question. John, do you mind if I ask what nonprofit company you are singing the praises of?
Yes, I belong to Desert Preferred Choice, which is run by InterValley Health Plan.
So this is a local nonprofit in that part of California.
The one InterValley Health Plan is in Southern California. They have two programs, one which covers the greater Riverside, Orange County areas, I think parts of L.A., I'm not really certain, and the Desert Preferred Choice.
Fascinating.
Covers only the Palm Springs, Coachella Valley area.
No, I got it. John, thanks for the advice. I think it's a great suggestion, and thank you for sharing that. She said that she will be eligible to sign up for Medicare on January 1st, if my recollection is correct. Thank you, John. Sally, in Dundalk, Maryland, you had a suggestion for that same woman who had been advised by her pharmacist to divorce her husband so she could afford her medications?
Yes, she may not have to divorce her husband at all. A long time ago, Congress was going to oversee the drug companies, and they came to a kind of compromise. When you get your drugs, you get this a packet or a paper in it. You know, it explains the drug, its side effects, its chemical composition, and all the other stuff. But on the back, all the way down, and you might have to look for it, there's a 1-800 number. Now, some other companies have a 1-800 number for the corporation, and some have it for a drug program. Mm-hmm. Where if you can't afford a medication, because I didn't get health care till Obamacare,
mm-hmm.
And I'm like 54,
right,
and I have asthma, so I can't afford half the inhalers they would prescribe. But what they did is they came a compromise with the drug companies. There should be a 1-800 number. Some of them have the 1-800 number for you sign up for this program they have,
mm-hmm.
and they will send you paperwork. And you fill it out and mail it in, and they say if you qualify, you may get your medicine for free, or they will give you a card where you only pay $20 for it. But it depends on how much you make.
Mm-hmm.
And your conditions,
right?
And you get it through the like AstraZeneca or Pfizer or the company that makes it.
So these are done and administered by the drug companies themselves, and their
correct.
Their contact information for that is at the very bottom of the back page of the prescribing information that your pharmacist staples to your bag with the receipt when you get your prescription
in the product.
Right, or the product liner. Okay, so it's the stuff that's attached to the product. Very good, Sally. That's brilliant. Thank you so much for calling and sharing that. I appreciate that, and I hope that she's still listening and that it's of value to her. You're absolutely right. Marcia in San Jose, California. Hey, Marcia, what's up?
Yeah. Hi, how are you?
I am well, Marcia. I hope you are too.
Yeah. Thank you for taking my call. Okay, well, Tom, my husband and I just finished reading your book, The Crash of 2016. Great book. Thank you so much for writing it. But my question to you is, what should people do with their money?
Right.
We have a modest, modest savings and some stocks. Where should we put it?
I'm not an investment advisor, Marcia, and I'm really reluctant.
I understand that.
Yeah.
And
the main reason why I'm reluctant to offer investment advice is that I've been a lousy investor my whole life. I've missed many opportunities, and I've blown a few, and I've made some really dumb decisions with regard to investments. I can say two basic principles for this moment in time. One is that when crashes happen, if you look back at the 30s, if you even look at some of the larger recessions that we had, for example, the Reagan recession in the 80s, that the people who get hurt the most are not the people who are totally overwhelmingly and hopelessly in debt, and they're not the people who are totally, have no debt at all. It's the people who have roughly half debt. In other words, they own a house, but it's only half paid off. So they've got equity in it, and then the value of the house collapses and that equity vanishes, that kind of thing. So the people who get hurt the worst are the ones who have to continue making their payments as the economy collapses altogether. And which is not to say that I'm suggesting that people get completely debt-free or totally in hock up to their eyeballs. It's just an observation, number one. And number two, there is an investment newsletter that I subscribe to that I find really useful. It's called the Aden Forecast, A-D-E-N Forecast. And I think the website is adenforecast.com, but you should be able to easily get it on with a search engine, DuckDuckGo.com or Google. And the Aden sisters who have been on this program before, it's been a year or two, excuse me, the Aden sisters are suggesting, broadly speaking, that the stock market's probably going to continue to go up for a while. We're clearly, in my opinion, we're clearly in a bubble, but buying bond funds right now, U.S. Treasury bonds or U.S. Treasury bond funds, you can buy them directly from the Treasury, or you can buy them in the form of like TLT, TLH, I think is another one. These bond funds are like the safe haven. This is the place where you park your money so that if the market collapses, you still have your money. And so that's the best advice I could give, I think, Marcia, with regard to investing is, find an investment advisor you trust, or, you could sign up for the Aden Forecast. I don't mean that as a sales pitch for their newsletter. It's just Louise and I have used it since the mid to late 90s, and it's been good advice. Does that help, Marcia?
Well, it does. Thank you very much. What about cash? The way your book implies is kind of seems like the bottom is going to fall out of everything. What about the cash? What is that?
My recollection is that the Aden sisters are suggesting that about a quarter of your assets be in cash. It might be a fifth now. I'd have to go back and look at the last newsletter. Most of it being in bond funds, some of it being in the stock market, some of it being in cash, some of it being in precious metals. They're big on that. I just can't say that I know. I'm a lousy investment advisor. Louise and I just, we're very fortunate in our lives to have made enough money in a number of businesses that we could make stupid investments and still come out okay. That's about it, Marcia. And the other thing is, I would suggest anybody who's in one of the big banks that just got the pre-bailout from the Cromnibus bill, might be a good time to start thinking about moving your money into a savings and loan or into a what do they call it? Credit union. Thank you, Marcia. Thank you so much for the call. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And my book, The Crash of 2016, just came out in paperback. So, it's a nice holiday gift, maybe. And welcome back, Mary, watching Free Speech TV in Tucson, Arizona. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Hi, Tom, and a very happy and joyous holiday to you and yours.
Thank you, and the same to you.
Thank you. I wanted to bring you up to date. I had called you a few days after the election to tell you about Arizona Congressional District Vote 2 in the race between Ron Barber and Martha McSally, and how the count was so close it was coming down to a recount.
Mm-hmm.
The state of Arizona just certified those results on Wednesday of this week,
mm-hmm.
and Martha McSally, the Republican candidate, is the declared winner by a large 167 votes.
Wow. Out of how many cast?
Well, in Pima County, where I live, the actual voter turnout was about 55%, which is about 450,000.
That's incredible.
Yeah, so it came down to 167 votes. So really, every vote does count.
Yeah, it really does, and we hear stories like this all over the country all the time. I mean, the last big high profile one was the Al Franken race. And the other high-profile one before that was George Bush and Al Gore in Florida. But on the smaller races, it just happens all the time. Mary,
right.
Thanks for the heads
and
up. Go ahead.
Well, if I may just talk about one more thing. Earlier this week, you had a gentleman on who was part of the religious right and vociferously defending torture.
Yes.
And you expressed your opinion, I think, beautifully and very powerfully. And then afterwards, you said you thought maybe you owed him an apology because you normally don't get that personal.
Right.
Tom, you owe him no apology. We actually need more people like you on the Christian left to speak out against these people who have hijacked Christianity and bastardized it and fetishized it for their own selfish interests. So I don't think any apology is necessary on your part, and I applaud you for speaking out.
Well, thank you, Mary. I'm not embarrassed or ashamed or apologizing even for the sentiment that I expressed, which is that torturing in the name of Jesus is abhorrent. I mean, it's a mistake the Catholic Church made in Spain in the 1400s, you know, it's abhorrent. But one of the kind of organizing principles of this show from day one has been something that I learned in the years that my dad and I fought like cats and dogs about politics, which was there's an old Christian saying, you know, hate the sin, love the sinner, that you separate the issue from the person. And so had I said the exact same thing I said to him, only in the abstract, it said, you know, any Christian who professes to embrace torture is, in my opinion, not a real Christian. You know, had I done that, I think I would have been proud of what I said. But because I said, Brian, I made it very personal. I broke my own rule. My own rule is, you know, don't pick on individuals. Give people a safe place to express their opinion, even an opinion that I strongly disagree with. So,
I still think you have nothing to apologize.
Okay, thank you, Mary. Yeah, it's a subtle distinction, you know, and it's a fine line. And we've been doing this show now for I think 11 years, and I typically walk it. You know, it's pretty clear to me where that line is, and I typically walk it fairly well. But anyway, Mary, thank you for your kind words. And yeah, I agree. We need more on the Christian left to be speaking out, you know, about morality in politics and in governments. Mary, thank you for the call. We'll be back. It's 10 minutes before that. Hey, thanks so much to our show director, Louise Hartman, to my executive producer, Sean Taylor, to our associate producers, Shane Farnan and Danielle Gilday, to our video director, Jim Javinsky, to our writer-researchers, Andrew Campbell and Nate Sweet, to Alva Goldberg for video production, to our webmasters, Nigel Peacock and Jamie Holly, to our business manager, Ron Hartenbaum, to all the folks at the companies that syndicate this program, Westwood One, Pacifica Radio, Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Cable Radio Network, Free Speech TV on Dish Network, DirecTV, and all the cable providers who carry our show, including Manhattan Neighborhood Network and all the others around the country. To all the great folks at Free Speech TV and RTTV who work on The Big Picture, to the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn, to Netroots Nation, to our newsletter editor, Sue Nethercutt, to the folks in our chat room, hey, to Ellen Ratner, Victoria Jones, Bob Ney, and everyone at Talk Radio News Service, to Jay Goodman Tamboli for tech support, to our affiliates, our sponsors, and to you for supporting our program. Thank you. Ken in Joliet, Illinois. Listen to WCPT. Hey, Ken, what's up?
It's getting close to Christmas, and, our treasury is out of money, and they're talking about delaying the tax refunds. Well, what I'm buying my granddaughters, I have one that's 5 and one that's 4 months old, is I'm buying them silver proof sets of their birth years.
Hmm.
That's
nice.
And the silver proof sets have not only the the dime, the nickel, the quarter, the half dollar in silver. They also have the extra four quarters that, are minted, each year now for, remember they did the states,
right.
They did the national parks. And,
right.
These things, I think I'm paying $53 for one, $57 for another, and I'm getting them at a local coin shop so close to Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
I know you have an advertiser that sells these things, so if people are looking ahead, they should go with your advertiser, of course. When my kids were little, I'd buy them Christmas hand-painted 1 ounce silver Christmas tree ornaments, with Santa driving a John Deere tractor for my son and, angels for my daughters. And on their golden birthdays, they got gold coins. It's something that, helps out the treasury and it's something that they'll have forever.
There's the thing that people have to know about this, Ken, is that there's two kinds of value in the coins that you're describing. There's what's called the bullion value. And if you're buying that silver set for $50 or $60, you're probably getting what, $10-$12 worth of bullion. And then there's the numismatic value, which is the collector value. Well, there's a third kind of value. There's the numismatic value, the collector value, and then there's the intrinsic value, the coinage value. But it sounds like you're getting like maybe $1 or $2 worth of coinage value. But the numismatic value, the collector's value, is something that does increase over time. The mint proof sets are pretty solid in that regard. On the other hand, if you have a really serious crash, the numismatic value tends to crash along with everything else.
Back when after the Hunt Brothers, debacle.
Yeah, it was in the 70s, wasn't it?
The price of silver went down under $3. I bought $125 face value and 40% Kennedy halves for 75 cents each.
Right.
I figured, my downside is a quarter, my upside is unlimited. I ended up having to sell those because my son died a couple years ago, and I sold them for four a quarter each, because the bullion value had of course risen, and I sold off my wartime nickels that actually took out of circulation for a dollar each,
Mm-hmm.
I think that, right now when the Treasury needs money, and this is a good thing to buy, your children and grandchildren.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. My dad always used to buy us Treasury bonds for birthdays and, when we became adults. When we were kids, we would get, of course, kid gifts. But every year... On our birthday, me and my three brothers, we would get a $100 treasury bond or bill or whatever they're called, which it was a 20-year maturity. So he was buying them for something like $43. And then, when you cash it in, of course, you're getting all the interest. And that's another way to do that. It's a little less, numismatic and gold and silvery. But excellent point, Ken. Thank you for calling and making it. Laura in Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening on KABQ. Laura, we have just 1 minute till the end of the program, the end of the week. It's all yours.
Okay. A short minute about Cuba, though. We were in Cuba after during the special period, right after Russia collapsed, and we caught a trip that was...
Laura, your phone sounds like it's disintegrating. I'm sorry, I've lost you. Sandy in Downers Grove, Illinois. You had a quick question, Sandy?
Yeah, I did some. I was wondering if you could help me out with a Christmas present for my son. You mentioned a science journal that you subscribed
to. Yes, yeah. It's called Science. It is the Journal of the American Academy for the Advancement of Sciences, the AAAS. And it's full membership. They have student memberships, full memberships, professional memberships. but I think it's around $90 or $100 a year. And it's a weekly magazine, and it's mind-boggling. It's wonderful. It's my favorite thing, and I've been giving it to my kids every year for decades. So that's and there are student memberships that are much less expensive. So plug into your search engine, Science Magazine, and AAAS, AAAS. Sandy, thanks for the call. And thank you all for being with us this week and for all your contributions to this program and supporting us, letting sponsors know that you're listening and stations and all, everything. I so appreciate it. We will see you on Monday. I'll be back here live. We'll see you on Monday. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. Tag, you're it. Have a great weekend.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.